Here we go, Dirt. Dirt is my cohort here. You might know him as Caleb. He's actually Dirt. He's very dirty. So that's his email, dirt@crossroads.net or dirt@briantome.com, whatever it is.
It's amazing how people get nicknames. I don't know what the origin story is there, but I'm sure there's something fun.
If you saw him, you'd know exactly why he's called Dirt.
I did see him on screen, and I don't understand why he's called Dirt, but I missed something.
Have you seen his feet? He never wears socks or shoes. And he's got dirt crusted everywhere. You didn't see that, did you? You don't want to see that.
Is it instead that he like digs up dirt on you and that's a way to...
Well, he could do that. He doesn't have to dig it up. He has it all on me, for sure. Welcome to The Aggressive Life. It was 57 years ago that the Beatles let us know the value of friendship. Speaking with Dirt, have you seen the movie? I think it's called Help. Is that what it's called?
The old Beatles movie?
Yeah, no, it's a new one. Oh. Gosh, I forgot the name of it. It's a guy who has some weird thing happen to him, and he's the only person on the planet who knows the Beatles and the Beatles songs.
No, I haven't seen
that. And he's this struggling artist, and so he pulls out this, it's really great. I wish, it'll come to me in a moment. Anyway, they had that whole song with, I get by with a little help from my friends. Ooh, I get high with a little help from my friends. Yay, I'm going to try all that whole thing. Problem is, most of us still aren't listening or not having that kind of high. Loneliness is an all-time high around the world, and we're suffering the results of it. Suicide's up, depression's up, dissatisfaction and listlessness are up, mental health issues are through the roof, physical health and life expectancy is on the decline. You and I, we're not designed to live alone. Lone wolves aren't healthy, they're sick, and that includes even after you get married. So back on Valentine's Day, author Rana Cohen published an op-ed in the New York Times titled "The Key to a Healthy, Stable Marriage." I read that, I'm like, oh my gosh, this is so, so good. What she's discovered in trying to get to the bottom of that question wasn't finding a soulmate or marrying the perfect person or making six figures. The key to a healthy marriage, including her own, is, drumroll, friends. I read that op-ed. I texted it straight to Dirt. I said, we got to get her on the show. And here we are. So, man, I'm really excited to have Rana Cohen. She's a DC-based journalist, author, and NPR podcaster. She's worked on shows like Morning Edition and All Things Considered, spoken at NASA and at universities around the world. And today we're going to dive into her new book, The Other Significant Others, Reimagining Life with Friendship at the Center. Welcome to The Aggressive Life, Rana Cohen!
That is the most enthusiastic introduction I have had.
It should be enthusiastic because I find your work fantastic, utterly fantastic. Let me just serve you up a softball for you to hit. I'm pretty sure you agree with me on this. That's what I remember from the article, but I'll just start the conversation, then just let you go on this. So when I talk with people who are married, which I'm married, so I'm pro-marriage, I know a lot of people who are married, I hear regularly from people, they say, well, my best friend is my spouse. And I always cringe at that, in large part because as a Christian, friendship is too low of a calling for a marriage. Like as a person who reads the Bible, it's like, you're one. Man, you're literally one. So let's park that aside. I still cringe because I think, I don't know if you saying they're your best friend might actually mean they're your only friend. Your thoughts?
Sorry, I actually opened the book by reflecting on this because I had gone to a string of weddings after, you know, the height of the pandemic and lots of people were getting married. And I heard again and again people saying that there's spouse to be was their best friend, which was especially striking with the visual of having the best man or the maid of honor standing right there. And it felt like those friends had just publicly gotten demoted. They were the best friends and apparently are no longer. And I had the same kind of skepticism that you do, that I think that we need to have friends. And if we are in this place where your spouse is supposed to be everything to you, including your best friend, it doesn't necessarily leave room for other close relationships in your life. And instead of encouraging everybody to find a best friend in their romantic partner, it might make more sense for us to have more kinds of support around us.
It seems like it's just harder to make friends now than it has been in the past. Is that true?
It's certainly not prime time to invest in friends if you're looking now versus hundreds of years ago or even thousands of years ago, where I think people understood that friendship could be the most meaningful part of a life. And part of this is tied to the expectations that we have around marriage, that, you know, I think of the Michael Bublé song that where he sings, "You are my everything," that is a way that we think about marriage now that people didn't in the past for reasons that partly had to do with how pragmatic the institution was. And they weren't expecting that someone that they weren't, you know, maybe even equal to is going to be the person they feel most emotionally connected to. So it left more space for people to have really intense friendships. I think there's a way that we've devalued friendships and we see it as a nice to have and not a need to have, while we also have put so much on marriage. That means that there's not really the room to give ourselves over to other relationships in a significant way.
Yeah, you made that point in the article, which just rung really true for me. You know, you are my everything. It's a standard that no one can live up to. You're my everything. So you're my lover. You're my best friend. You're my co-breadwinner. You're the raiser of my children. You're my meaning. You're my identity. You're my playmate. You're my fix-it person. You're my thing that gives my life purpose. Gosh, if my wife told me that, that would be a crushing responsibility to have, you know? But yet we say these things and they're reflecting a reality that's just not possible. And what it's actually saying is, I think we've got a pretty underdeveloped understanding of what marriage actually could be and should be.
I think that people do this simple math that bigger is better, that if you put more onto marriage, then that means that it is a more important relationship. And that instead, we kind of have to turn our logic around and say that we are overloading marriage and asking more of it is actually making it weaker. And we maybe need to distribute the load, apply the same principles we would to finance or any other kind of realm where we would say, don't put all of your eggs in one basket. And to see that having other strong areas of life can make our marriages stronger rather than expecting one relationship to deal with every single kind of role and burden that we have in our lives.
Do you think that this could be one of the reasons why divorce statistics are so high, that it's maybe not so much a reflection that the other person isn't being a good spouse, but maybe it's a reflection that our life isn't going the way we want it to go and we're blaming our spouse who should be our everything and making our life good? Do you think there's anything in that line of thinking?
You know, I think that that's very plausible. One way to answer this is by kind of talking about the reverse, where I was speaking to somebody who runs a co-living community where basically she's managed to get a bunch of her friends, about a couple dozen of them, to live in the same building. And she has found that people's lives just seem to improve, not just their social lives, but that their careers improve, that their romantic partnerships or dating lives improve, and that they end up finding that there's a secure base that they have when they are surrounded by people that they're really close to, that they're able to take risks. They're able to, you know, try new things that they wouldn't otherwise, and that all of life ends up getting better. So if that's the case on the positive end, I can imagine that if all you have is one relationship to form your identity, your meaning, to deal with every high and low, that it might, not help the romantic partnership, and that instead, if the other parts of life are going well, then you might not put all that pressure on the partnership and might not blame it if things aren't as wonderful as you would hope them to be. I think a kind of tragic potential consequence of all the pressure we put on marriage is that people exit relationships that they might have actually worked out quite well in, but that they're blaming the relationship rather than the expectations that make it impossible to succeed in that relationship.
Tell us about the stress hormone cortisol and what you've learned about that in relationships.
There's a particular study that I came across that found that, you know, they're looking at couples who dealt with some sort of marital conflict, which all couples do, and found that people who had a lot of satisfaction with their social ties outside of the marriage experienced less of a spike in cortisol, this stress hormone, when they were dealing with marital conflicts, that essentially the friendship was a buffer against the slings and arrows that came in the marriage. So, you know, there's a way that these types of relationships can enrich each other, can support each other.
How are we doing friendship relative to, say, the ancients, let's say those in Rome way back centuries and centuries ago? Are we doing friendship differently than our forefathers and foremothers did?
In the past, people saw friendship as a much more significant relationship than we do now. So the kind of language that you would hear in ancient Rome, where people are talking about their friends, is language that we use for romantic relationships now, like saying that a friend is the better part of my soul, or, you know, the greater half of my soul. It was in same-sex friendships that people expected to find their emotional and intellectual companionship. A lot of these, you know, ancient thinkers saw friendship, particularly male friendship, as integral to society, to the state, to a good life. So it is very different from now, where friends are the thing that people may or may not squeeze into their lives and see them as just friends. So, you know, there's this way that we denigrate friendship and lower it down, where historically it has been the relationship that brings so much meaning to life.
So what do you think is going on, Raina? Because I'm a bit confused. I look at the statistics and just the anecdotal data of people I know and things I see. There's fewer and fewer friendships that are happening. I look at marriages, and there's fewer and fewer people who are getting married, fewer and fewer people who are dating, fewer and fewer people actually who are having sex inside of marriage or outside of marriage, or having sex with themselves in various ways. But it just seems that all human connection in any sort of relationship seems to be going down. How can this be? Why is this? Would you agree? And why would this? You would think that, like, okay, we're not getting married, but so we're spending more time with our friends, or we're not having friends so because we're getting engulfed in a marriage relationship. It just seems like across the board, all human connection, whatever sector it is on the decline. Why is that? And do you think I'm wrong?
People have been talking about this for decades. I think the most famous example would be from Robert Putnam's book, Bowling Alone, where he was talking about really the rise of television as having these real ramifications on the way that people socialized. So, you know, instead of going to bowling leagues or other kinds of local social organizations, that people were spending time on their own in front of screens. And that was decades ago. And, you know, I think that the situation is much more severe now. And people's ability to opt out of in-person social interaction is a lot higher, you know, a lot easier to scroll in front of your phone. It will probably occupy you even longer than a television would. I think that there are certain skills that we haven't really learned that well to cultivate that are involved in developing friendships. You know, one is like dealing with potential rejection. I think at least in romantic relationships, we're told that that's like par for the course, and people will suck it up and get on dating apps and deal with potential rejection. But, you know, it's hard to put yourself in a position where you're telling somebody that I'm really interested in getting to know you, and you don't know how they feel, and that it is easier to, you know, be in this a safe realm behind a screen where you are, you know, communicating with people who maybe you don't know all that well, that there's that risk. With risk comes reward, but a lot of us aren't willing to take the risks. And, you know, I think talking about relationships in a serious way, including friendships, might help people actually put themselves in a position to develop that closeness that a lot of people aren't finding right now.
it's really fascinating to look back at the way things were and the way things are now. It just seems like everything is stacked against relationships and discussion. I mean, you mentioned Putnam in the television study from whenever that was, and I was just going to my mind of, I love that I can watch TV without commercials. I hate commercials. Like, TV is just dead. Like, broadcast TV, dead. Who wants to watch any commercials? And radio, sorry, if you're in radio, you're dead. You're going away, because I want to listen to Spotify, and whatever I listen to doesn't have any commercials in it. But boy, back in the old days, everyone had to watch the same thing, right? Instead of everyone doing something different, everyone watched the same thing. And I remember my kids were young watching American Idol, and we'd watch it, and then the commercials would come on. And what would you do during commercials? You would talk with each other. I like this person. I like that. There was like these little breaks where you would talk, and we don't have breaks to talk today. It's all go, 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 or consume with my screen or whatever it is. It's really sad.
Yeah, I do think that there's this pursuit of efficiency that has permeated so much of life. A few months ago, I wrote a piece about what adults can learn from kids' friendships. And so much of that comes down to time and our relationship with time. As kids, we are not trying to squeeze the most out of every single minute and hour, and we can just do nothing together as friends. Or maybe, you know, those commercial breaks wouldn't bother us because we would make our own fun. And, you know, as adults, I think we have this sort of pursuit of efficiency. You know, another thing I would say is that our lives are set up for many of us in a pretty isolated way, where we go off as individuals or maybe in units as a couple or as a nuclear family and are not necessarily making decisions about how close are we going to be to friends or to, you know, any other close ties. And I see the contrast with friends of mine who are religious. So, you know, I live with two friends who are observant Jews. And if you are observant, you need to be in walking distance of a synagogue that you can attend, which means that you end up having a cluster because you're on Shabbat or, you know, the Sabbath.
Fascinating.
If you are observant, you aren't supposed to be using technology, so you wouldn't drive anywhere. You know, this is if you're very observant. So if you're in walking distance, that means that you've created a community that's in walking distance of each other. And so people will go to each other's house for Shabbat dinner or lunch on Saturdays. And it is a kind of difficult thing to coordinate around a particular place. There are a bunch, you know, you're constraining where you can live, where your kids can go to school. I don't know, you know, what your commute is like, but people have made the decision that sacrifice is worth it in order to live in a community. And I think that is so not the way that a lot of people live, where the community is like, well, I'll go and figure it out rather than I'm going to organize my life with the certainty that I will have it.
That's fascinating. I did not know that about some Jews who are observant. That's brilliant. Love that. It's somewhat similar to what where we live right now, Raina. We moved into a community where there was basically a neighborhood where there was, oh gosh, about four people we knew. And I was one of the pulls of it. Hey, we got some of our closest friends that are right here. And then maybe our closest couple friend just decided a couple months ago to buy a house in the same neighborhood. And because we were there, and it met a bunch of other things. And that, boy, those seem to be really countercultural excuses to buy a house. You don't find many people saying, I want to buy a house because it's going to make me have a richer relational life. Maybe that's why we're struggling as much as we do and have as much mental illness. Do you think that's part of what's going on behind the mental illness spike, that I just personally don't understand how it keeps going up, up, up? It just seems like a epidemic of mental illness just kind of swept through our country. And like, where did this come from? Do you think how much do we think it's tied to our loneliness?
I think there are a lot of factors involved in this, but certainly being disconnected from other human beings does not help with people's loneliness. I mean, there's research pointing to the connection between our social lives, particularly friendships, and loneliness, that people who don't report having any close friends are far more likely to say that they are lonely than those who have, you know, quite a few close friends. So there seems to be something that's going on there. You know, on the point about it being countercultural, it's so interesting because the example I just gave you was a very traditional community that's making the decision to live near friends. So I think there's a way that it is both quite ancient and traditional and radical in this moment because, you know, not prioritizing simply a career or, you know,
housing values.
Or, you know, what makes sense for the couple or the kids, but saying that we're actually going to place community or friendship really high on the list, if not first, that's something that people have been doing for a very long time, but is kind of, you know, foreign to us now. And I think if you say that you're going to live near friends, which is something that, I have a lot of experience saying and doing, that there's a way people will be surprised and maybe interpreted as juvenile. In some cases, I think people think of it as the dream, but they don't think of it as a dream that you can achieve, that it's something that maybe they'll be like the Golden Girls, you know, in their 60s or 70s, but it's not something that as an adult, you know, in your 20s, 30s, 40s, that you're going to make your social relationships outside of a marital one, the thing that you build a life around.
Yeah, Lib, my wife's name is Libby. Lib and I were just talking, we've been talking last month or so. It's interesting how as you age, you start having conversations that you've never had before. You know, so I'm 58, she's 73. No, she's not quite 73. She's older than me. It's an ongoing joke. She is older than me, but we've been talking about, okay, what's our end game? Where are we going towards the end of our life? When we're 80, where do we live? Who are we with when we're 80? And family is great. Having kids close by, which we have, is just utterly fantastic. And we've actually in large part structured our life around that. But, and our grandkids, but to expect your kids to be your primary friendships and for them to alter their life to be your primary friend support is really a heavy burden, unrealistic thing. I mean, they're not going to be connecting with things that you're dealing with when you're 80. I mean, they'll serve you, be around you, have some fun, but they can't be your primary friend network like some people want them to be because they're into different things and doing different things. And so we've just had to think through as we're married and as we're going through this stuff, let's keep community connection friendships at the top of the list. Critical.
I've actually have been thinking about not just how spouses are maybe overloaded with expectations, but I've also seen a lot of cases where kids do too, where there's, you know, the parent doesn't have friends and wants and says that their child, I often see this with daughters, that the daughter is their best friend, which, you know, can sound sweet on some level, but it creates a kind of
codependency.
You know, I mean, I've seen situations where the daughter's not so happy about it. So it's not so much codependency, but it's a feeling that they are weighed down with obligation and that they, you know, friendship is a reciprocal relationship that is really the most egalitarian relationship that you know, you could find. And it's, I think that people want to map other kinds of relationships onto friendship because they don't actually have friends or don't know how to have friends. And it doesn't tend to work very well for any kind of relationship if one person feels like they have a ton of expectations that have been put on them that they, you know, maybe can't live up to because it's unrealistic and there's, you know, they didn't opt into it and you're kind of dealing with the potential of disappointment or just being told that you're going to have to do more than is possible for one person. So I think moving away from the idea that one person, whether it is a spouse or your child, is going to complete your life and make you have meaning where otherwise it wouldn't be meaning, is going to destabilize the relationship because one person can't bear all that. And if you really care about that person, then trying to find ways, maybe with their support, to have others in your life who you can turn to as well will make everybody happier in the end.
I love that phrase. I've never considered before, Raina, that friendship is the most egalitarian relationship in the world. That's deep. Maybe that's part of why we have such a hard time with it is we're used to serving somebody And instead, sometimes we have to be an authority to our friend, or we're used to being the authority, and instead we got to serve our friend. There's times you got to be an authority and step in their life, and there's times you got to serve them. And I think most of us are probably comfortable with one or the other. It is, you are right. It's a constant quid pro quo, and where you got to uphold a level of energy that the other person, if they're not upholding that level of energy, the friendship's going to go stale. Right? I mean, talk more about that. Most egalitarian relationship there is. Anything more you want to say on that?
Well, I would say it's egalitarian because it is mutually chosen. And there is a lot of theory around friendship as having to occur between equals. But I think it's also our most improvisational relationship. In marriage or in a parent-child relationship or in a, you know, supervisor-employee relationship, there are scripts around how you behave, who is responsible for whom, what kinds of conversations you have. You know, in a romantic relationship, for instance, you have a define the relationship conversation about, you know, what are, you know, are we moving to being exclusive? Are we going to move in together? Do we want to have kids? And with friendship, there's, you know, kind of constant negotiation that if you are, you know, open to conversation together that you would have to have without any of those sorts of scripts, because friendship can run the gamut from somebody that you see every few months to someone like the friends that I write about in my book, who you might see five times a week and who is your plus one to parties and, you know, who is part of your daily routines. And we are not given the scripts to discuss with our friends in a very clear way what our expectations are. So we have to improvise it and, you know, deal with the transitions in friendships without the kind of structure that we have for other relationship types.
And we have to exert a level of energy that's somewhat commensurate with the other person, or it's not going to work. Lib and I are having over for dinner in a couple weeks, some really good friends that we want to become closer and closer friends with. And one of the reasons is this couple has just done so much for us in initiating things to do. And we realized, man, these people are putting out all the work and initiating for the friendship. We got to put out some work. Let's have them over and have some wild game meat. I'm a big hunter, so I've got elk meat and all kind of other stuff that we're going to do. So, but that was sort of a friendship drive of this is what friends do. Now, if it's just obligation, like, okay, they've asked us out, now we have to ask them out. They're not asking that. That's not the heart of it. And if we've got to constantly fire ourselves up to ask somebody out, well, maybe they shouldn't be our friend. Maybe we're just not getting any energy from them, right? But I love that phrase, that egalitarian. Both people have got to be spending energy instead of just passively sitting back and hoping that everything goes well for me. That's why it's called the aggressive life. If you want a good friend, you have to be a good friend. You can't expect to have what you don't do.
And on one of your earlier questions about kind of what is going wrong with friendship today, I think the passivity is a big part of it, that a lot of people think that friendships are going to happen because, you know, at a point in our lives, like when we are children, friendships do happen. We have the conditions that where we are constantly around other people in school, and you don't have to do very much. You have structured activities, you're playing sports or doing theater or whatever. And when you're very young, you can just walk up to someone and say, do you want to be friends? And then that counts as a friendship at that point. So, you know, when I was talking about the skills that we don't develop, it's like, well, if our lives are not set up where we are constantly around our peers, then friendship is going to require some initiation. And that's, you know, not necessarily what many people think. They just think that a friendship is going to arrive. And I think the hard thing, you know, the balance here is to see friendship as a relationship that requires some amount of work, that in the way that we expect marriages and familial relationships to involve work, but also, you know, to maintain the kind of excitement and pleasure and, you know, the reward that comes, that it is not a total relationship of obligation, but neither should we shirk away from the work that it does involve, because all close relationships require us to give somewhat of ourselves.
Yeah, maybe that's why so many guys who I talk to, their friend is one of two sectors. Either one, it's somebody they work with, or two, it's somebody they went to college with, because there was structured activities in college. There were things to do and all that stuff. And they name somebody they're working with because they see them all the time. Of course, if they change jobs, they're probably going to lose that friendship because it's based on that activity. But to your point, it's like these are the things that just passively happened, which sometimes passivity is great. If you get something good out of it just accidentally, like making a good friend in the playground, that's great. But you get to a place in life where if you want deep, meaningful friendships, you're going to have to spend some energy. You have to spend some time. You have to spend some money.
I think that the, you know, that scenario that you're alluding to is a good thing for people to ask. Like if I left this job or I left the setting where I made this quote unquote friend, would the friendship remain? And if you think the answer is no, then maybe it's not a real friendship, or it's a sign that, okay, I really do want this person in my life. So I need to find ways to make it more intentional. And why don't we spend time outside of the office or, you know, outside of wherever the run-in was going to be so that we are ensuring that we know how to maintain this relationship. And also you might get to know each other in different contexts. I mean, I will say personally, like I sometimes have trouble making like true friends at work because we get so easily into shop talk. Yeah. And that for me, connecting is about, you know, talking about other areas of life too. So it also can make the friendship stronger potentially by moving it out of this one context and having, you know, multiple ways that the person can know you, which, you know, you can do, go on a hike together or do some kind of activity where you will be talking about things that aren't just the joint activity that brought you together in the first place with no, you know, outside effort of your own.
Yes. Raina, I want to read you some of the things that you've written, which I think are darn good, which is why I want you in the podcast and why I want you to talk to it again. So let me just give you your own words and then let you riff on it, okay? You say, sociologists have found that married people have weaker relationships with neighbors, relatives, and friends than single people do. We end up undermining romantic relationships by expecting too much and weakening friendships by expecting too little. Go.
Well, on that first point, this is a reference to some research that was done by, you know, sociologists who were trying to understand, is marriage actually the cornerstone of society, as we say? And what they ended up finding was that often couples are so focused on supporting the marriage that they aren't really looking outward. You know, their marriage has been called a greedy institution because it is, at least, you know, in today's age, because it takes up so much energy for people. And that, you know, in fact, it was like single people who were going to check in on their parents and, you know, involved in political activity and so on. So I think it's worth questioning whether what we hear about marriage is actually reflective of the reality, and does it make sense for us to be so, you know, gazing into each other's eyes in our marriages and not always looking outward to the other ways that the stability of the marriage can support other people, you know, who we're close to or other parts of our community. You know, in terms of the second part about undermining romantic relationships by expecting too much, I think we've talked about the many ways that happens, and that we don't realize friendship's full potential because we think of friendship as just friends, as the thing that you're going to fit into your life if you have time. And you know, what I saw through the friends who I interviewed for my book who are close enough to be life partners, so you know, extraordinarily close, is that friendship can be so much more intense and invested in than we think. And also that many of these people have both a friendship and a romantic relationship, which shows how much room a lot of us could even make within our marriages, that we could fit a whole other, you know, person who is basically as close as a spousal relationship and still have plenty of time and energy to devote to the marriage. And what I heard from people where they had both of these, you know, this platonic and romantic relationship simultaneously, is that those relationships enriched one another. So it's a very different way of thinking about how do we, you know, invest our time and our energy to the relationships in our lives. Does it all have to be in one person? And right, what kinds of expectations are making us happier or not?
Yeah, different people can fulfill different roles, and even different friends can major on different things that we need over other friends. Not every friend is going to be a deep source of wisdom, and not every friend is going to be a bowl of laughs every time you get with them, you know? So having a diverse range of friends is really a good thing.
I mean, I would not want anybody to expect that I'm going to do all the things perfectly well. Like I'm well aware of my weaknesses, and I want to get better, I suppose, at those things. But it is a relief to me to know that there are other people, like in, when I have, I'm in sort of some groups of friends, and knowing that there's a friend doesn't always have to turn to me, that there's somebody who's maybe better suited to help, or that I have multiple people who I can go to. I mean, that makes me feel relieved.
Yes. All right, let me give you another one of your quotes. Through our setup, I've arrived, speaking of you and your husband, I've arrived at a clear sense of what an ideal marriage looks like to me. Not one in which my husband and I are cocooned, gazing into each other's eye as lovers are so often depicted, but looking outward, anchored in a circle of people we love.
So this was a reference to the way that my husband and I have our living set up, which I mentioned earlier that we live with two of our very close friends, and they also have two children. So we share a home together. And this is a pretty unusual way for people to live right now, that I think the ideal is that you pair off with your partner and you live as a separate unit.
Happily ever after. You live happily ever after, meaning just you two, happily ever after, everything's great.
In our case, we have found that we have a richer relationship because we have these other influences in our lives. We have our two housemates who bring out different sides of us. I mean, one big thing is that my husband loves children, and by living with children, I get to see the side of him who is goofy, that is extraordinarily patient. Like I remember when the older kid was, learning how to put caps on and off markers, and he was just doing it again and again. And I was kind of bored to tears, but my husband was, just sitting with the kid patiently and fascinated by his developmental stage that he was in, that he was able to do this. And there are things that I get to appreciate about my husband that I would not have had opportunities to witness otherwise, or maybe it would take years until, we had kids or like some other kinds of things happened where the influences from my friends were something that I would get to see. So we have found that we understand more dimensions of each other and get to appreciate each other, appreciate the time we have together, because we're often in these other kinds of configurations, and, we've loved it.
Yeah, that's good. Flying K Ranch. Today's episode is brought to you by them because I believe they're producing some of the most mouth-watering, healthy burgers, steaks, roasts I've ever had. They're in Findlay, Ohio. Flying K raises their beef with no hormones or antibiotics, so you know you're getting the most natural product. It's a family business, partnering with state and national certification boards to ensure both cattle and customers are happy. You can find out more, place your orders at flyingkranchangus.com. That's flyingkranchangus.com. I'm liking it a lot. Taking care of your health isn't always easy, but it should be at least simple. That's why for the last 2 years, I've been drinking AG1 every day, no exceptions, at home, on a hunting trip, camping off my motorcycle, no exceptions. It's just one scoop mixed in water once a day, every day, and it makes me feel ready to get moving. That's because each serving of AG1 delivers my daily dose of vitamins, minerals, pre and probiotics, and more. It's a powerful, healthy habit that's also powerfully simple. I like to have it in the morning. I have a 12 ounce of water, so right off the bat, I'm helping my hydration every single morning. This is the one product, if I had to recommend one, I'd recommend this one to elevate your health. It's AG1, and that's why I partnered with them for 2 years. So if you want to take ownership of your health, start with AG1. Try AG1 and get a free 1 year supply of vitamin D3 plus K2 and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first purchase. Go to drinkag1.com/aggressivelife. That's drinkag1.com/aggressivelife. Get yourself some. Raina, I think you're of very rare stock. I can't do this with everybody, but I think you can handle the lightning round. I think you got what it takes. The lightning round is when I ask you a question, you have to answer it like a bolt of lightning, like a sentence. You got to think quick and you got to get it out. Do you think you're up for the lightning round?
I will do my very best.
Yes, you will. You will succeed. And if you don't, then we can always edit. Okay, here we go. The last friend you saw and what you did together.
Mine is my housemates. I went over a friend's house last night who lives a 5-minute walk away, and we hung out, had some tea and candy after her child went to bed. It's a weekly routine we have.
That right there is just profound. I mean, there's a lot of people that can't even remember the last time they left their house only to spend time with a friend, let alone walk 5 minutes. That's pretty cool. All right. You're one for one so far, Raina. Good job. I knew you could handle it. Okay, here we go. Next one. Most effective way to support your partner / spouse's friendships.
Encourage your partner to have close friends, and encourage them to set aside time for friends and ask about those relationships like they matter.
I tell people, I'll add on my own little thing to that. I say frequently that when a spouse doesn't have really good friends, I think the other spouse feels vulnerable. The healthy ones do. The healthy ones. You know, we feel like, this person doesn't have a backdrop. This person might not be getting truth spoken to them. This person, my spouse, might be having too high expectations for me. Would not have the same life if I didn't have friends, because I'm a better husband because I have friends, and I have less demands of her because I have friends, and vice versa. You agree with that?
I've heard that from so many people, that the one way this happens is that the friendship ends up being a place to go to talk about things that maybe you would give like the rough draft to your spouse, and to not be quite as, volatile I've just heard again and again that people said that they are better spouses because of their close friendships that are often their first stop for, the big, big kind of things that are going on for them.
Yeah. And we're talking good, solidly grounded friends, the kind of friends who, if you say to them, my wife did X, Y, Z, I can't believe she did that. It's just so, and there's a lot of guys who would just immediately and instinctively respond with, well, screw her. She didn't know how good she has with you. She's not going to be able to do X, Y, Z. But instead, my friends would say, hey, man, she's got a point there. You got to think about that. We need those kind of friends, not just yes men and yes women.
You need trust.
Yep. All right, next one. Best way to find a great friend.
There's a lot. I think finding people who have shared interests helps, but I think maybe the thing people need more is to know how do you make a friend once you've found somebody that you're interested in. And I think one is sharing enthusiasm. I'm a little over the top, so I've told people that I have friend crushes on them, but you can find
friend
your own
crush.
Way.
We'll stop right there.
Yeah.
Friend crushes. You tell them that. Tell me how that works. Tell me how that works.
Well, a few weeks ago, I'll give, the latest example. At a book talk that I gave, friends brought a couple of their friends along. Afterwards we had dinner. I sat next to this woman and we just clicked, and we don't live in the same city, but we kind of wanted to keep in touch. And I told my friend, let Julia know that I have a friend crush on her, and you can send her my number. So then we texted and we found a way to meet up in the couple hours I was still in the same city, and she ended up driving me to the airport, and we're going to try to find ways to keep in touch. So, I could have just told her it was nice to see her, but I decided I think she will appreciate this, and I'm gonna. And if she doesn't appreciate it, then it's fine. I don't my life will not be over. But in the best case scenario, we're going to get to build a friendship, and it's also just so delightful. I think on the receiving end to know that someone thinks so highly of you, that's a beautiful thing.
Man, sometimes, Dirt, I wish I was a woman. I really do. That's such a beautiful and healthy, great thing to say. As a guy, if we talked about having a friend crush, we'd be ridiculed, we'd be laughed at. Even like the ways that we talk about friendship, we're constantly speaking down to men as it relates to friendships. Like even the phrase, and we'll laugh about it, like bromance. I have a bromance. Okay, I laugh at that a little bit. But you know, the thing is, like, there must be something sexual because it's really weird that you as a man would want to hang out with another man. The playing field and the cultural customs for men are just not good. And when I hear you say that, I think, man, I wish more guys would be that jovial and open. I love that, a friend crush.
Well, I will say I have a whole chapter in my book about masculinity and the kinds of obstacles that a lot of men face to having these sorts of friendships through no fault of their own. And I do think that it is unnecessarily hard. And that also as a cultural, we sexualize all types of close relationships, but yeah, it's especially difficult for men to be close with each other without being the butt of jokes or, you know, have it like themselves fearing that, people will think that they're gay and then stigmatize them for that, that there's, you know, there's a lot going on that I think makes it particularly hard for straight men to build these sorts of close friendships. And it does not help their relationships with women to then have only women as the people that they can talk to about the things that are going on in their lives.
What do you mean by that? Doesn't help the relationship with women?
So what ends up happening is that women will have close friendships and men will just have their romantic partner in straight relationships. So that, you know, when we're talking about the burden, that there's a burden on all kinds of all romantic relationships when we expect one person to be everything. But I think that it's actually even tilted more toward women having to bear kind of everything that their husband can handle. I mean, to give one example, I write about these two men who are very close friends, one of whom is straight and one is gay. And one grew up in a quite, you know, in an environment where men weren't supposed to touch each other, men weren't supposed to get close to one another. And as this guy, Nick, became close to his friend, Art, he started to wonder if he was gay because he was experiencing things he had never experienced before in a friendship. Mm-hmm. And he told his friend, well, like, I miss you when you're gone. And I want to, you know, I like hugging you. And his friend, Art, was like, that's just emotional intimacy. Like that's not sexual attraction, but but Nick had never experienced intimacy in a male friendship before. He'd only experienced it in a romantic relationship. So that shows, you know, one person being the entire locus of your intimacy is really a lot to ask. And, and it's easier for women to go to multiple people for that.
Well, well said. My first time over in India, I was really pushed when I saw these guys on the back of these trucks going all through the city. I mean, India is just when you get off the airport, specifically in Mumbai, it is an assault on the senses. The moment you get out of the plane, body odor and stench and overcrowding, and you can't drive anywhere without seeing people urinate, sleeping on sidewalks. It is so jammed. It's
sounds a little like New York.
I haven't been to New York for a while. It's hard to imagine.
It sounds like I spent a lot of time in New York. Some big cities are not that different from one another, but
it's a different level. But when I was there, the thing that was really moving to me was you'd see these work trucks and guys going to jobs and stuff, and they're hanging out in the back of the trucks, like with their arms all over each other. They're like arms around each other's shoulders. They bounce down the thing, and my initial reaction was, huh, is there a higher percentage of gay people here in India? And then I caught myself I was like, no, that's my problem. I have a problem showing physical affection to other guys, and this culture doesn't at all. and something's just wrong with me. I just think we'd be a lot better off. We gave each other as guys, not just handshakes, but hugs, you know, grabbing the back of the neck, rub the back of the neck, whatever it is.
Yeah. There's an amazing book called Picturing Men that shows ordinary photos of men throughout the 20th century. And the ones from the early 20th century, men are in each other's laps. They have their arms around each other. There is just this physical proximity that, you know, over time you don't see as much anymore. And part of that is the fear of being perceived as gay because it becomes this identity and a stigmatized one. I mean, before the turn of the 20th century, we don't even have the terms homosexual or heterosexual. So there was a lot more freedom for you know, all same-sex friends, but I think most notably for men, to have that kind of closeness that we are now so easy to jump to and to say that this is a sexual relationship. And in many parts of the world, you will still see men holding hands, having their arms around each other, right. That there is that kind of ability to show affection to, you know, platonic relationships.
All right, I'm going to jump into the controversy waters here. I don't want to. This should not be controversial at all, but it will be. And I hope you still like me after I say this. I just want to process something I watched last night. Have you seen the show The Last of Us?
I have not seen that show. But I know I have some vague idea of what the series is about, but tell me more.
Yeah, it's basically The Walking Dead, except with there's a fungus that's gone all. I'm not ruining it for anybody. Normally, if you have to explain the illustration ahead of time, it doesn't work, but I'll do it anyway. There's a fungus that goes throughout all of humanity. People are dying. This fungus is growing. There's anarchy taking place with power structures that are left and basically Walking Dead zombies. You don't want to get bit because you're going to get the fungus and all that stuff. And now here's the controversial. So give me grace. You and I probably have a worldview that's a bit different from one another. I am a conservative Bible believing Christian. I don't know if you are or not, but you'll need to identify yourself. But I have. So therefore, I've got some beliefs that are outside the mainstream, specifically around sexuality. And I was told that there was a whole episode with these gay guys who are preppers, and I was like, oh man, I don't. Okay, and the reason I hesitate on it is just I feel like very frequently my worldview is just, demeaned. I feel that way. Could be on me, but I feel that way. So I finally had enough friends say, this is a great show. So, okay, I watched it. And when I watched that, the one episode, and it's all about who's the guy from Nick Offerman? Is that his name? Right?
I know who Nick Offerman is. I don't know if that's who you're
thinking
of.
Yeah, it is. Parks and Rec. He's kind of traditional manly man guy. Well, he's gay and he's a prepper. He's a hyper survivalist. And there's another gay guy who wanders around just by chance. They meet each other. And the whole episode is about these guys and their relationship and they're prepared and they build a life together and some other people come in and out, all this stuff. And what was really beautiful about it, really, really beautiful, while some people would see in this that this is a romantic relationship, and certainly that was the intent of the writers. It was a romantic relationship for sure. But what I found as I watched that is it really challenged me to say what these two guys are doing, how they're looking out for each other, their tenderness with one another goes way beyond the sex scene in the bed together. I mean, you could take or leave that, whatever your worldview and conviction is. But like, I watched this and said, anybody should be able to take a look at a relationship between these two guys that has empathy and tenderness and humor and sacrifice for one another. That should be what every guy has, whether gay or not. And I ended up being really challenged by the episode. It was good stuff. But if you haven't seen it, then, you know, you haven't seen it.
Well, one of the kind of central questions that I'm interested in my book is, what is partnership? And, you know, to what extent is sex a vital part of partnership? Because here I am looking at people who, you know, like the two men I mentioned earlier, Art and Nick, they met training to be youth pastors at a Christian college. And, you know, one is gay and celibate and the other is straight. They treat each other, they consider each other family, have lived together. They do not have a sexual relationship and yet they have built a life together. And, I think that there's, with the language we were talking about earlier about just friends and more than friends, we treat sex as a dividing line, I think, between which relationships matter and don't. And, don't pay attention to what are the other things that are happening in a relationship that is that we might admire. And that is, you know, devotion, commitment, tenderness. And that can happen within the context of a romantic relationship. It can also happen in a non-romantic relationship. And even I think the things that we value so much within marriages are not entirely it's not just the sex, it's all the other parts. And we can bring more of those parts to the other kinds of connections in our lives.
Well, Raina, you're a voice that's bringing us a drink of nice, cool water when we are just scorched as it relates to relational connection intimacy. So well done. I love the work you're doing. You've helped us greatly today. Before we get close to checking out, is there anything that you wanted to talk about that we haven't talked about yet?
Well, I'm glad we ended up getting to touch on the experience of men in these sorts of friendships and the obstacles for them. And I think it's, we would have a kind of better world for all of us if we're able to disaggregate intimacy from sex, if we were able to understand that there are different kinds of ways that we can be close to one another and not assume that there's just one, and then be value that over all others, and then be afraid of closeness because we might fear it's turning into a romantic relationship.
Yeah. Raina, this has been great. And for everyone who's with us today, hey, look, Raina is a really good thinker. She knows what she's talking about. She's done the research. And you could view this podcast right now as just more research for you. Oh, I learned more about friendships. Oh, I learned more about what my marriage might be able to need. Hey, if you use the aggressive life for research and information dissemination, you are not the target market. The target market for the aggressive life is somebody who wants to make moves in their life, do something other than passively hope a friend comes. So do something here. There's something you heard that you can do. Find a friend. Be a friend. If you're married, initiate a conversation with your spouse about what their friendship expectations are, what they think about where you are relationally. Start where you are right now. Make your life better by making an aggressive first step. Raina, if anyone wants to get a hold of you or your work, give us an advertisement for yourself.
Well, my first name is pretty unusual, so it's easy to find me. It's spelled R-H-A-I-N-A, so I'm Raina Cohen on Instagram and Twitter. I think the most exciting thing is to read the book that I wrote that came out recently called The Other Significant Others, Reimagining Life with Friendship at the Center. It's a book that profiles people who have these extremely intense friendships, and I think there's so much that we can learn from them and ways that they model for us, what friendship can be. Even if we don't want to go to their kind of Olympian level friendship intensity, there's much more room for intimacy and commitment and closeness and enriching, our familial and marital relationships at the same time by really investing in our friends.
Fantastic stuff. Raina, thanks for giving the time, for also giving me grace for being a couple minutes late today. You're a good woman. I'd love to meet you in live in person someday. But in the meantime, keep doing what you're doing. You're a voice in the wilderness. Go, 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 go. Well done.
Thank you. It was so good to talk.
Yes, it was. It was for me anyway. All right. Hey, we'll see you next time on The Aggressive Life.
Great, we got it. Thanks, Raina.
Thank you.
Perfect, Raina. Great word. If you got anything you want to adjust or anything, just let us know. We'll make it happen. We want you to feel good about the podcast and hopefully get some more book sales, okay?
I appreciate that. Yeah, no, and I very much am glad to be able to have conversations where, like, I think there are ways that we probably are similar and things that are different. And
right.
I really wanted to write the book in a way that is accessible to all sorts of people. I don't think that this is just something that, I don't know, one subset of the country or society should care about. So I'm really very happy we got to have this conversation.
Yeah, we don't do a good job in our country anymore of interacting with people who have different viewpoints, different worldviews, different practices. It's like, we need everybody to be all in on my beliefs and my practices, or I can't have a conversation with you. Maybe that's why we have so few friends, you know?
Yeah. Well, I will say I've been, I talk about a number of religious people in the book, but the chapter that's about the two men who are conservative religious Christians is one of the chapters that people have have reacted strongest to and have been like, they've like loved their story and been very moved by it. So I'm hoping it's, one way of like showing there are all sorts of people that all of us can learn from and feel connected to.
Yeah. Yeah.
See ourselves in.
That's great.
Yeah.
Well done. Yeah. Well done, Raina.
All right. Well, thanks for this again.
All right. Have a good day.
You too.
All right, bye-bye. Thanks for joining us on this journey toward aggressive living. Find more resources, articles, past episodes, and live events over at briantome.com. My new books, a repackaged edition of The Five Marks of a Man, and a brand new Five Marks of a Man tactical guide are open right now on Amazon. If you haven't yet, leave this podcast a rating and review. It really helps get the show in front of new listeners. And if you want to connect, find me on Instagram at Brian Tome. The Aggressive Life is a production of Crossroads Church, Cincinnati, Ohio.